interviewed me for this position before I went to the Hebrew Union College, the president of the congregation, in essence, only had one question to ask: can you read Hebrew? It's kind of funny.
Love it. Wonderful.
The only other thing about that was funny about Schulenburg was it was extremely hot, and of course I didn't have much money, so I wore the only blue suit that I had, which was a very heavy winter suit.
What did the congregants wear when they came to synagogue for High Holy Days?
Well, this was Texas, but yeah. It was Texas in the 50s, so they were formally dressed. Yeah. But they also pulled a fast one on me, which, you know, later on I wouldn't have allowed to pass. They said to me, look, Rabbi, we have it in our tradition that we continue the service. Don't have a gap, as the Union Prayer Book of those days had, but just continue straight on, which I did. And of course, by 3 o'clock, we were finished.
And this is Yom Kippur.
On Yom Kippur.
Okay.
And by 3:30, of
you
course, and that was the reason for it, the World Series began.
I see. Well, that happens quite often.
What
during
was cool
that?
At 3 o'clock.
Oh, no.
And
that was the night before.
No, I don't mean memorial service.
Must have been at 1:30.
Now, that happens quite often.
No,
you,
it doesn't. The World Series is where they...
During High Holy Days, I...
Yeah, it used to, not anymore because of
the extension. Yeah. You said that this congregation in Oklahoma didn't have money to pay the student rabbi. Were the student rabbis were paid?
Yes. You
yeah,
if you
okay.
went out to a high holiday position to a bi-weekly congregation, you were paid.
I see.
Yes. They paid your fare and they paid you a small stipend.
I see.
The bi-weekly congregations began in the fourth and continued in the fifth year.
And you had a regular
yes,
pulpit?
Yes. You go out every other weekend, rode a train to two places. I can't think of the one in Kentucky. I'll think of it in a minute. A little town in Kentucky, which was very nice. And it was just Friday night, really, and Sunday morning we taught Sunday school, and Saturday we made some visits. If anybody happened to be sick, it didn't happen very often. Try to amuse yourself, because it sure wasn't much to do Jewishly on Shabbat.
Well, didn't the Jewish people invite you for dinner?
Oh, on Friday night, of
sure.
course. And that was always a bit of an adventure, because the first thing they tried to do was, some of them at least, was test you. You know, you'd come, and they'd ask you, what do you want to drink? If you allowed them to, they would give you a very stiff drink. And I guess to see if you could make it through the service after that.
So what did you do?
Well, you learned fairly quickly what was happening. And you also had lots of amusing experiences. You know, you had people who showed up for dinner so late to take you to their place that you had given up and started to eat in a hotel. Or you go to a family that really wasn't getting along very well, and in the middle of the supper, they were under the table trying to separate the children. You were the only one left on top of the table.
But I'm sure you made some good friendships as
oh,
well.
Oh, yeah. You make some very nice friends in that way. And I'll think of the name of the town in just a moment.
But you went to the same town?
Only the one
the
year.
Whole year?
Yes. And
okay.
then the second year
you had another.
To another town, this time in Indiana. It was a little more possible to get some adult education going there. There were some young people fairly enthusiastic, including a daughter and son-in-law of a rabbi. And then in the middle of the year, I came here.
So you came in before your through graduation from the Hebrew Union College.
I hadn't been ordained yet.
I see.
Couldn't perform any marriages, and hadn't graduated.
You came here, what, 54, 55?
55.
Did you come here to be interviewed and to meet the congregation?
Well, see, this was, I was just temporary.
I see.
So I met with Dr. Freehill, and he talked to me for an hour. I listened. And at the end of that time, he said, I think you'll do.
That's refreshing. And when you say temporary, how long?
Well, I knew at that point that everybody who graduated, unless they were a conscientious objector, were expected to serve in the military. So I knew that was coming, and I wanted to do that. And so this was going to be till the end of the summer. And then somebody else would take over. So I came, I found a place to live, a modest apartment in the building next to the Fairfax. I forgot what the name of it was, one room sort of an apartment.
On Fifth Avenue.
Fifth Avenue. We were undergoing construction. So there's a big construction site where the Freehoff Hall and the new school wing is. And Dr. Freehoff's office was in the school library. The assistant's office was where the religious school principal now is. The school was on double shift, and I was really needed because the assistant at that time was Harold Silver. He was trying to hold down this position as well as his new position as rabbi of the congregation in the South Hills, and that just wasn't working.
The congregation of South Hills.
Temple
Emmanuel. That was new at the time.
It
was, that
was
right?
Yes, he was their second rabbi.
Oh, their second rabbi.
I think their second.
Okay.
Rabbi, yes.
Okay.
I was obviously very young, probably looked even younger, because I remember that Pauline Hirsch, who took care of organizing the confirmants for their confirmation, about 100 kids in those days. First time I went out there to see the kids, I sat down on the pulpit, and she came out and said, what are you doing up here? Go back and sit down where you're supposed to
be. Oh my. And what did you tell her?
Well, I sort of told her I was the rabbi. She was
poor name.
We got to be good friends. She was a very able, tough lady. And she was able to handle those kids and let nothing slip by.
What were your duties as assistant?
Well, as assistant rabbi, you did, as all of Dr. Freehoff's assistants and mine, everything. Right from the beginning. So after I had listened to about two or three sermons, I said, I wanted to preach. Okay, I did. In what I, of course, was unable to do in those first months that I was here, was speak without notes. But I saw him do it, and I thought that was a useful device. Sat in on a few weddings and on a few funerals, started going to the cemetery regularly, and taught in the Sunday school, everything, right from the beginning. Went on calls with him, and he didn't have a car, so we always went calling together.
How, in a bus or a taxi?
Oh no, in my car.
Oh, and you had a car?
I had a car, yes.
So
I took him, and he was... The pastoral rabbinate was not his style. No, he simply, to the best of my knowledge, for the 11 years that I was assistant and associate rabbi here, he may have made two true hospital business. I think that's about it. At home, we tried to call on people who were bereaved, but did so in very limited numbers.
So that was...
I mean, if we made three calls a weekend, it was a lot. And my guess is that I always had some cards. I probably had 10 cards.
So you made the rest of it? Is that what you're saying? No.
I didn't think that appropriate either.
I see.
So the rest were not made.
Well, that's interesting. Now, did your father make calls?
Oh, yes.
To everyone who was ill or...
Oh, yeah, but you know, in Springfield, Missouri, how many people are going to be sick?
Right, I understand.
And a funeral, they were, I mean, my father, when he heard the number of funerals that I was involved with, was kind of astonished, because funerals were so few and far between in Springfield, you had to look at the rabbi's manual to see, you know, what were the prayers.
I see.
Was
it a shock to come to such a large congregation immediately?
Well, it was interesting,
yeah.
Because there was obviously a lot of opportunity to do things, and you immediately, from a bi-weekly congregation where you may have had 10 people on Friday night or 15 people on Friday night, here on Shabbat morning or on Sunday morning, where you had a congregation. And of course, those were the days of Sunday morning services and of much more formal, everything was much more formal. If Dr. Freehall would see me now sitting in his former study in short sleeves without a jacket, he would have been shocked. This was not done. And at the services, we wore formal attire.
You mean morning suits?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there I was, striped pants, and you know, afterwards I'd go for lunch someplace and maybe start wandering around town, and people would look at me and I would wonder why.
When did they give that up? When we first came, they were still doing it.
Well, he did that, he continued to do
that. Yeah.
When I came back from the military chaplaincy, I did not. I just wore a dark suit. Mm-hmm. That was it. But I had no... and then when summer came, in June, he left for Maine, and I, who had now been ordained maybe for a week, was in charge of Rav Sholem for the rest of the summer. He was sort of interested.
I'm sure it was. So you did everything?
Yes. Now, we didn't have any summer programming in those days. So it was services and funerals and weddings and some teaching. Nothing really extensive. So there was still time, if there was nothing on a weekday, I decided to explore the countryside. I remember driving to Cleveland before there was a turnpike and going into the hills of West Virginia and going up to some of the state parks. I also remember one of the things that happened was, I've forgotten whether it was then or whether it was later, but easy to establish, the Kaufman funeral, Mr. Kaufman Sr., who was buried at Falling Waters.
So, and the ceremony was there?
Well, just the interment.
I see.
The funeral was in the temple.
Here?
Yes. And there were calls about that from various Catholic employees at Kaufman, who in the 50s didn't know whether they would really be permitted to go into a temple. And I also remember his very skillful handling of the eulogy.
Tell us about it.
Well, Mr. Kaufman was a very good and generous man, but he also had his weaknesses.
And
that's correct. And so, in order to paint the picture correctly, Dr. Freehoff started off by saying, "We are bearing a Renaissance prince."
Oh, that's wonderful. But this was Mr. Kaufman's wish?
What?
I mean, he established himself. He wanted to be known as a Renaissance.
No.
No?
No. He didn't want to be known as a Renaissance prince. That was Dr. Piazza's idea.
I see.
Of covering up some of the things that people would think of when the eulogy was going on.
Okay.
I don't think I'll be more specific
okay.
than that.
I understand. Very well. But so that funeral was when Dr. Friel was here. That was not that summer.
No, that was when he was here. And in the summer then, I had some conversations with Lester Ayres about a wide variety of things, because he was interested in finding, in seeing what I thought about young people and how things should go and the like. Then was sworn in as a first lieutenant. And, well, before that, the man who was going to take my place, a classmate of mine, Philip Gershon, came to the city, and for 2 weeks I introduced him to Word of Sholem and what the local customs were and what he was supposed to do. I was his trainer, strange as that sounds. And I left for the Air Force.
And where were you stationed?
Well, I went to Air Force. To a school in San Antonio. There's a chaplaincy program with a couple of Jews. There were one classmate of mine was Air Force also, and there was an Orthodox rabbi. And that was, of course, again, a totally new and in some ways bizarre experience, because we were first lieutenants, we knew nothing. We got the rank. So the first time, met another officer coming from Springfield, Missouri. He said, "How are you?"
Was he above you? Did he have a higher
sure,
rank?
He was a colonel.
Oh, my word. Did you have to go into the guardhouse or something?
No, they realized who we folks were. And then we were put in, we had to march. And we were put in charge, and of course, we'd forget the orders, so our group of chaplains then dutifully obeyed what we had were supposed to do and marched straight into the wall.
I assume you didn't get hurt because someone above was watching out. Well, after the basic training, then what?
Well, when the basic training when I saw what the nature of the training was, it was really intended for people. First of all, intended to get us all acquainted with other religions. So there were sort of a basic course in all the other religions, which contained people we might have to take care of, so we should at least know what we were supposed to do. And then there were a lot of things which I saw would be of no use to me, because they were intended for those people who were making this a career. I was going to be there for 2 years. I knew that. So I decided very early that this was a path of education where I did not need to excel. And I sat in the back behind a very big chaplain to be and spent most of my time reading. Passed the course, but also got a fair amount of reading done. And by the way, that was also possible earlier in the Forest Service, because we were, go back to that for a moment, we were in camps. One camp was 30 miles from the city, not from the city, from a road, the end of a road, and we were supplied by mules. And so we were really completely on our own. And I brought some books, and on rainy days, you cut wood, if it wasn't too rainy, you could slip, or you just sat around the fires, because it was always cold enough to have a fire, even in the middle of summer. and read or learned. I guess I should have learned a ukulele.
When you say we, how many were in your group in this isolation?
About 30 people.
In one group?
Yes, and it was isolated enough that you washed in the stream. There was no, you had a pit toilet because you dug them. One summer we had real problems because we had a bear that kept marching up and down the breakfast table. Eventually, they got permission and they shot him because it was just a great nuisance. That summer, that was also quite interesting. The cook, everybody knew I was Jewish because I didn't make any bones of that, and on Friday night I always conducted a little service for myself. When he found out I was Jewish, he had been a naval cook in the Second World War. Whenever ham was served, he cooked fish for me. Didn't ask him for that, but he did that. And a couple of us also went hiking off into the wilder parts of the woods. And there you were really alone. You were maybe 50, 60 miles from the nearest person.
That was before you signed in and signed out in the National Park.
Well, no, this was National Forest.
National Forest.
Yeah. And we were on our own anyway.
I see.
And one friend of mine from that experience then spent a summer. He decided he really wanted to spend it alone in the forest. So he got a horse and he panned for gold.
Yes.
Well, I did a little of that too in Montana, and got enough to pay for the summer.
Wonderful. Talking about your dietary habits, your family kept a kosher home, mm-hmm. even in Springfield, Missouri.
Yes.
When, do you keep a kosher home now?
No.
When
well,
did
we, in a modern, we, okay. we don't, not kosher meat.
Do you change dishes?
We do not change. Okay. We change dishes on Pesach.
Okay. When did you stop observing?
Kosherwood, I guess, strange as it sounds, at the Hebrew Union College.
Why?
Because they were serving.
Oh, they weren't, they don't.
We're not kosher
really
at that point. But that's also, the Hebrew Union College, aside from the camp situation, the Orthodox camp in Maine, was the first time that I had Jewish friends. The kids in Springfield, we were acquaintances, but we were not friends. So from Augsburg to the Hebrew Union College,
That's interesting. Where were we? We were in the army.
Yes.
You
San
were reading
Antonio.
And didn't you decided you didn't have to excel.
Correct.
Okay.
At the end of that course, they assigned us to the holidays, and I took a group of soldiers around to the services. To an Orthodox service in San Antonio, which was also rather amusing because that synagogue, Orthodox, separated men and women only on the first five rows. After that, anything went.
What's the rationale for that?
There is no rationale.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And then they, by law, they were supposed to ask us. And we had to put down on paper where we wanted to be sent. So we were all gathered together, and we filled out our sheets. I'm sure I put down Europe. And then we went upstairs and got our assignments.
And where were you sent?
I was sent to the Philippines.
Okay.
Well, the assignments were there, but we had to do this in order to be correct. And started to read a little bit on the Philippines, which was very difficult in those days. There wasn't much literature. And flew out to San Francisco out of uniform. But I wasn't going to spend money on a winter uniform going to the Philippines. And flew across the Pacific.
And where were you stationed?
station at Clark Air Base in the Philippines, which is about 50 miles out of Manila. And at that point was a major airfield, and I was also, I was with an Air Force, the 8th Air Force, which had a spot for a Jewish chaplain. It didn't have many Jews, only about 50 Jews on the base. And so I was responsible also for 3 naval installations.
In that area?
Manila Harbor, Sangley Point, and Subic Bay.
It's not so close.
No, they are about 50, 60 yeah. miles. And made those rounds regularly. Then found that that really wasn't, you know, sufficient as far as I was concerned. So I looked to see where else there were Jews. There were Jews on Taiwan, and there were Jews in Southeast Asia. So I slowly expanded this to include those areas. And on the holidays, high holidays, conducted services. Usually in the morning, everybody would come to Clark, you know, from the Navy bases and so on. And then in the afternoon, I would fly off to Taiwan and conduct services the next night for Rosh Hashanah in one place in Taiwan, fairly far north, and then for the next morning, fairly far south.
Okay, so how far in miles is Taiwan from Manila? Pretty far.
It was probably about 800 miles.
So it was a, what, 4-hour airplane?
Yeah, it was a, I decided then that the best way to serve these outposts was to go regularly. So every month, I went to the Navy bases, and I had some funny situations. You'd go in a Jeep. So here I was, driving on this Navy base, this huge Navy base, to an aircraft carrier to see the chaplain, who had an office which was about the size of my bathroom right there. I was a first lieutenant driving a Jeep. I still remember one of those occasions when another Jeep came toward me, and this was driven by a naval officer. Why? Because the person in the back seat saluted. He was, of course, saluting the person in the back of my seat. He was nobody. He was a rear admiral. He thought that this lieutenant was driving a general. But it was interesting, mainly because this was a time, there was no war, but there was a lot of tension. Once I flew from Manila to my monthly service in Taiwan, in the nose of a bomber at about 500 feet, and you could see...
Pretty loud.
Yes.
Yeah.
You could see the military preparedness of the Chinese on Taiwan. The number of gun installations, the number of military formations that were ready at their disposal. And then it was interesting because on this air base, Clark Air Base, there were maybe 150 planes from which we had lent to the French when they were still trying to subdue Vietnam. And they had given them back to us, and we were repairing them. And so they had French markings on them, yet, that were on this American base. And I got to Southeast Asia a couple of times. Went to Saigon once. Had to go in civilian clothes because they had a strict quota on military personnel. And looked for, see if there were any Jews there. And what the main thing I tried to do in these more isolated places was to provide them with appropriate food, matzahs, wine, and so on. And that was real easy because the Jewish Welfare Board, which supplies people in these positions, still thought that there were hundreds of Jews out there. So they sent me enough wine to be able to get anything I wanted to done by the Filipinos. And it was very useful.
Why did they think there were so many Jews still
left
from WW2?
Well, it
was just on
their
books. Yeah. I see. And this is before Vietnam.
Before Vietnam, after Korea, before Vietnam. And there were some tense moments. I mean, once or twice we had formations, not of B-52s, but their predecessor, I think was a B-47 or something like that, with atomic weapons. And that meant security all of a sudden was extremely tight. You couldn't go near the tarmac, even as military people. And then there were also other opportunities. First of all, it was interesting to see the Jews in Manila, a small Jewish community.
Where'd they come from?
All over the world.
Really?
But there were a lot of German Jewish refugees
that in Manila.
Became very good friends. Well, this was the end of the earth.
Yeah.
And of course, they suffered during the Second World War. For a while, they didn't, because the Japanese didn't know what to make of them. You know, they occupied, they put all the Americans into camps, the civilians as well as the soldiers. Here were these...